Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you all for being here today. Can everyone hear me well? Good. My name is Anna Mikunyi, and I work here as a lecturer, and I also teach art history at Vassar College. This lecture examines a few works of art and cinema that incorporate citations from past art in the form of performative renderings. So we'll look at artists and actors that imitate figures from specific paintings and sculptures. Our geographic focus is Italy, and the works we'll look at span the period from 1963 to 74. We'll concentrate on three quite different figures: Pierpaolo Pasolini, Michelangelo Pistoletto, and Luigi Ondani. I'm currently finishing my dissertation on the work of Ondani from the 70s at the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this presentation draws on my doctoral research. Now I'd like to ask you to please silence your phones, and feel free to ask me questions at the end of my talk. Let me set the stage with a film by one of the greatest filmmakers of post-war Italy, Luchino Visconti. Senso was released in 1954. The title was translated into English as Livia, or The Wanton Countess. It is a historical film set in late 19th century during the period of Italian unification. Senso marked a decisive shift in Italian cinema. As film scholar Gian Piero Brunetta put it, it reconnected Italian cinema with opera, literature, and painting. For the purpose of this lecture, we are interested in the third element, the relationship of the filmic image to painting, as this makes Senso an important precedent to the works discussed in this lecture. Senso was the fourth feature film by Visconti and his first color production. It was also one of the first color films to be made in Italy. And now I'm going to show you a clip from the opening sequence shot in the Fenice Theater in Venice. The opera being performed is Il Trovatore by Giuseppe Verdi, whose plot unfolds in 15th century Spain. References to specific paintings from the historical period in which the film is set abound in Senso and later films, as in Il Gatto Pardo, The Leopard, released in 1963. The Leopard is another historical film set at the time of Italian unification. This is a still from the final sequence of the film, with Burt Lancaster playing Don Fabrizio, the protagonist of the film, another still from a subsequent moment in that final sequence. Visconti dressed Lancaster just like Verdi in the portrait by the Italian painter Giovanni Boldini. Brunetta wrote that Visconti, quote-unquote, reconnected Italian cinema to painting. In fact, a culture of the filmic image informed by pictorial models emerged in Italy in the 30s, was later criticized for about a decade, from the early 40s to the early 50s, and was then embraced again by film directors such as Visconti and, later on, Pasolini. Pasolini was already a well-known writer when he started his career as a filmmaker in 1961. We're now going to focus on his third film production, La Ricotta, which is a short film, part of the multi-directed compilation of shorts released in 1963 with the title Rogo Pag, after the initials of the director names Rossellini, Godard, Pasolini, and Gregoretti. La Ricotta is a film on the making of a film on the Passion of Christ. In the film within the film, There are two tableaux vivants of famous Manierist paintings that are staged. Both depict the subject of the deposition. We're going to focus on one of them. But first, what is a tableau vivant? By definition, a tableau vivant is constituted by one or more live costumed figures who remain motionless and silent as if in a painted scene. The tableau vivant we're focusing on stages the deposition by Pontormo in the Church of Santa Felicita in Florence, executed in the second half of the 1520s. I'm going to show you two clips on the recreation of this painting. And I'd like you to notice how Pasolini dealt with the horizontal format of the filmic image by stretching it to the sides. And as you watch these clips, pay attention to the presence of elements that highlight the fictional character of the mise-en-scene. Also notice the contamination of sacred and profane, as well as elite and popular culture elements. This is a striking and intense close-up of the actress playing the role of Mary in the deposition. And like the other actors in the scene, she wore simple draperies held by iron wire designed by Danilo Donati, who worked for Visconti before and from now on collaborated with Pasolini on several of his films. And here is the second clip. Studied art history at the University of Bologna in the early 1940s under one of the most prominent Italian art historians of all times, named Roberto Longhi. Pasolini said that when he was behind the camera, he had in mind the frescoes by Masaccio and Giotto, the painters he loved most, with some mannerists like Pontormo. He stated, quote, "I cannot conceive images, landscapes, and compositions of figures outside of my initial passion for 14th century painting. I always conceive the background as a painting background, like a scenery, and this is why I always attack it frontally," unquote. The opening sequence of La Ricotta exemplifies what Pasolini meant when he said that his cinematographic taste did not originate in cinema, but the visual arts. Here is the opening sequence. Thank you. In its frontality, frieze-like arrangement, and symmetry, the opening scene does not quote any specific paintings, but references several, including early Renaissance representation of the subject of the Last Supper, and the final close-up on the table with the wheel of ricotta cheese, after which the film is titled, recalls Baroque still lifes, like this one. All these references overlap with the strong presence of contemporary popular culture and music. I'm sure you've noticed the opening titles in highlighter yellow. The whole thing is quite an interesting combination, right? The longing for a beloved past that Pasolini felt was something he had in common with the 16th century mannerists. Pasolini declared his love for the past in a famous poem and had his alter ego in the film, the actor Orson Welles, playing the film director, recite them. I'm going to show you that clip now. By the way, the opening sequence and the tableau vivant are the only color scenes in La Ricotta, and they are also the first color scenes in Pasolini's cinema. So the rest of the film is in black and white.
Io sono una forza del passato, solo nella tradizione è il mio amore. Vengo dai ruderi, dalle chiese, dalle pale d'altare, dai borghi dimenticati sugli Appennini e sulle Prealpi, dove sono vissuti i fratelli. Giro per la Tuscolana come un pazzo, per l'Appia come un cane senza padrone, o guardo i crepuscoli le mattine su Roma, sulla Ciociaria, sul mondo, come i primi atti del dopostoria, cui io assisto per privilegio d'anagrafe, dall'orlo estremo di qualche età sepolta.
La Ricotta constituted a clear break in Pasolini's production. It was the first tangible sign of an existential and ideological crisis that caught Pasolini in the early 60s and was linked to profound changes in Italian society. It was only later on that Pasolini articulated his thoughts about these changes. And I'd like to show you now an excerpt of a speech by Pasolini on these issues that was aired on TV in early 1974.
Con la omologazione del fascismo non è riuscito assolutamente a ottenere il potere di oggi, cioè il potere delle attività di consumo, invece riesce a ottenere perfettamente, distruggendo le varie realtà particolari, togliendo realtà ai vari modi di essere uomini che l'Italia ha prodotto in modo storicamente molto differenziato. E allora questa culturazione sta distruggendo in realtà l'Italia. E allora posso dire senz'altro che il vero fascismo è proprio questo potere delle attività di consumo che sta distruggendo l'Italia. E questa cosa è venuta talmente rapidamente che noi non ci siamo resi conto. Abbiamo visto in questi ultimi 5, 6, 7, 10 anni. È stata una specie di incubo in cui abbiamo visto l'Italia intorno a noi distruggere, sparire, adesso risvegliandosi forse da questo incubo e guardandoci intorno.
For Pasolini, these radical changes resulted in what he called an anthropological mutation of all the different Italians in the Italiano Medio, or average Italian. It was a transformation that invested all social classes and their systems of values and beliefs. Consumerism was the culprit, and that meant the so-called economic miracle of the late 50s and early 60s, which less than a century after the birth of Italy as a unified nation in 1861, made the country one of the major industrial powers of the West. And now it sounds a little awkward given the actual present situation, but that is historically the case. And industrial development was accompanied by a national political project of unification and centralization. In order to counter the persistence of local dialects, Italian language started being taught on television, which was becoming a mass phenomenon in the early 60s and only then, and a highway connecting the north with the south, the Autostrada del Sole, was being built between 56 and 64. So Pasolini's preoccupation with the past and the particular local traditions of Italy was tied to an indictment of capitalism and consumerism. The dramatic changes in Italian society had produced a larger and unified middle class that made national popular cinema meaningless, and that was what Pasolini was devoted to before La Ricotta. But the culture industry also produced something good, as affordable books with color reproductions of artworks. Pasolini used one of these books for the mise-en-scène of his tableau vivant. On the right is a stage-set photograph of the reconstruction of Pontormo's deposition, with in the foreground a book by Giuliano Briganti on mannerism titled La Maniera Moderna and published in 1961. Unfortunately, the stage-set photo is in black and white, but the images in the book look like the one on the left, I promise. The book by Briganti was one of the first with color illustrations to be published in Italy, and it was part of a series dedicated to Italian painting directed by Longhi. And the influence of Briganti's book was not limited to reproductions. The interpretation of mannerism that Pasolini identified with was that of Briganti. The art historian described the mannerist as wild and at the same time repressed, not only because of their own over-intellectual approach, but also because, quote, as individuals, they found themselves at odds with a society which had neither the moral strength to guide their difficult, unconfessed longings into other directions, nor the awareness to free them fully, unquote. Mannerism was the period immediately following the Renaissance, and it was a time of disquiet and profound changes. Think of the Copernican Revolution, the Protestant Reformation, or the Counter-Reformation. It is not difficult to see a parallel between this shift and the collapse of Pasolini's own ideological beliefs. Another good product of the new industry of art publications with color reproductions at affordable prices was the monographic series I Maestri del Colore, the Masters of Color, published by Fratelli Fabbri and sold weekly at newsstands starting in the second half of 1963. This series signaled a major change in the circulation of art reproductions as it offered full-page, high-quality color illustrations for the masses, and it was very influential on artists. The Fratelli Fabbri publications were the starting point for a short film by Pistoletto, Michelangelo Pistoletto, titled Pistoletto and Sotheby from 1968. In the film, Pistoletto and his wife, Maria Poppi, staged several tableaux vivants from European paintings, mostly from the 19th and 20th centuries. In the clip that I'm about to show you, Pistoletto and Poppi are redoing a painting by Ingres, Raphael and the Fornarina, in which Ingres imagined a tableau vivant of Raphael, the Italian Renaissance painter, with her lover and model, the Fornarina, here in a portrait by Raphael. As you will see, they propose an updated version of Ingres' painting, with her own kids jumping and playing around. Just a little warning before you look at this clip, that the soundtrack here is more like a noise track. So the noise track is a little unpleasant, right? As perhaps is the instability of the image, More than a tableau vivant, this looks like almost the visualization of a strange, tormented dream. But there is a whole tradition of experimentation in 20th century art that does not want to please its audience, so keep that in mind. Pistoletto is a painter and sculptor from Turin who started to make performance art in 1967. In contrast with Pistoletto's distorted and somewhat wild interpretation of Raphael from a painting by Ingres, here is a rather suave impersonation of Raphael by another artist from Turin named Salvo. He posed as Raphael from a famous self-portrait by the 16th century artist in a black and white photograph from 1970. If we flip the painting by Raphael, we'll see a closer resemblance, although we want to notice that Salvo is dressed in contemporary clothes. Pistoletto is best known for his mural paintings, which feature life-size figures, either painted or photographed, on polished stainless steel that reflects the surrounding environment. An early work of this kind from 1964 is on the left and is in the collection of MoMA, in fact on view upstairs, as far as I know. The smaller black female figure is a reflection, and on the right is a later work from 1970. It is, of course, a photograph of that work, and it includes the photographer, Ugo Mulas, who took the picture, and also other works by Pistoletto displayed in the same space. But since Pistoletto and Sotheby is a rather unknown work, I'll show you another short clip from this film, which is 25 minutes long. In the film, right before the scene you'll see, Pistoletto puts an issue of the Maestro del Colore on the table. You'll hear a piano playing atonal music in the background more prominently than in the previous clip, superimposed with some sort of excruciating lament. So here we go. So looking at the toes of Pistoletto's left foot going up and down, perhaps we can hear the voiceover in Pasolini's film scolding the actors for not staying put. So here Pistoletto picked again a painting in which another painting was referenced and reinterpreted. It is James Ensor's self-portrait with a flowered hat, in which the Belgian painter posed as the 17th century Flemish painter Rubens in a self-portrait. As you can see, there is no flowered hat in Rubens's painting. It was a whimsical addition of the eccentric Belgian painter that Pistoletto rendered rather carefully. What we have here is a painting within a painting, just like the Ingres, and similarly to Pasolini's tableau vivant, which are part of a film within a film. Ontani, too, is interested in this artistic strategy, which is called mise en abîme, and consists in embedding or nesting a given image within another image that refers to the first image. In Ecce Homo, from 1970, we have an explicit kind of mise en abîme, as Ontani is holding an image of the work he's redoing by Guido Reni. What Ontani is holding here is a santino, or a pocket-sized, mass-produced religious image. While for Pistoletto, staging tableau vivant from past paintings was an exceptional practice, for Ontani it was not. Ontani likes to remember that this is the first work in which he posed as a character from a past painting. It is titled San Sebastian in the Wood of Calvenzano after Guido Reni, also from 1970. For this impersonation, Antoni used the full-page color reproduction published in the Fratelli Fabbri monograph as a visual aid when posing for the camera. Reni painted several versions of San Sebastian, and Antoni picked the one he found in the Fratelli Fabbri series, which was also the one he could have seen in the local museum, the Pinacoteca Nazionale in Bologna. Antoni was born in Vergato, at the time was actually based there, and Vergato is a town near Bologna in the Tuscan-Emilian Apennines evoked in the famous lines by Pasolini, "I'm a force of the past, only tradition is my love," remember? Reni is a Baroque classicist painter of the Bolognese school that, according to birth records, was born in Bologna, but according to an age-old oral tradition, he was born in Calvenzano, which is a hamlet of Vergato, hence the title and the identification of Antoni with Reni. It has been said that San Sebastian is the single most successfully deployed image of modern male gay identity. And although certainly Antoni's work carries a homosexual implication common to other depictions of the saint, it also bears specific connotations that pertain to him individually and to the particular painting he chose to recreate. Antoni said that he was drawn to the subject because he saw it as a powerful simulacrum of ambiguity, desires, and illusions. San Sebastian, he said, quote, reveals the inevitable sensuality of a male youth, and more in general, the ambiguity of art. This is why I immediately identified with him, unquote. Let's now compare these two works for a moment. Reni's depiction is already an enigmatic one. The arrows that traditionally pierce Sebastian's body are missing. Yet Antoni's remake removes all references to pain altogether. The gloomy setting and the menacing sky in Reni's painting has been replaced by lush vegetation and a bright sunny sky. The atmosphere in Antoni's Sebastian is that of pleasant inactivity, the dolce far niente of a midsummer afternoon. Rather than glancing heavenward and placidly surrendering to his own destiny, Antoni as Sebastian is shown whistling, his gaze lost in reverie. There is something of the detached, carefree spirit of Pasolini's actor, isn't there? As in La Ricotta, in some of Antoni's works, there are direct references to Mannerist paintings. This is a still from a 1970 video titled Favola Impropriata, in which Antoni imitates a portrait head by the Mannerist painter Arcimboldo, using two apples, a bunch of grapes, and a pear. This was one of the first color videos made by an artist in Europe and is almost 40 minutes long. Here is the clip that shows Antoni staging the pose. He's not going to use the banana. But it almost looks like a portrait right here, right? say I modified the volume of these clips to be all the same, and I think something happened to the visual quality of the video of the clips. So the areas are not supposed to be like this, but at least you don't hear all the clicking from changing volumes. So I'm sure, close brackets, you've noticed the rather improvised period of the tableau vivant. A number of Ontani's impersonations are single figures from larger composition, as this work from 1974, in which he poses as Ariadne from a painting by Titian. And Ontani revisited the greatest icons of Italian Renaissance art as Michelangelo's David. But notice how Ontani's version seems rather ungainly in comparison to the powerful and, in fact, monumental marble sculpture by Michelangelo. Ontani's photograph, I should say, is life-size. Ontani also recreated Michelangelo's famous slaves for the tomb of Pope Julius II, both the finished and the unfinished sculptures, such as this one, known as the Young Slave. Now, back to San Sebastian, Ontani published this work for the first time in the art magazine Flesh Art in 1974. Flesh Art still exists today. It was founded in 1967 and still is the most widely read Italian art magazine. So it was an important occasion for Ontani to have his work published there. Ontani wrote a text to accompany the reproduction of San Sebastian, and in this text he voiced his frustration with cultural homogenization, the same cultural homogenization Pasolini was speaking about in the clip I showed you from 74, the speech. And so he attacked the conformist and repressive bourgeois society in which gender and power are divided and kept separated. And in contrast to that, he said he welcomed in his work and life the wonderful possibility of being at the same time masculine and feminine, and also embracing citations, ambiguity, and anachronism. When Ontani started to make his impersonation in 1970, Italy had just plunged into the darkest period of the country's post-war history, the so-called Anni di Piombo, or Years of Lead, as the Italian press dubbed the 70s in reference to the armed violence from both the extreme left and right. It was a period marked by a streak of politically motivated violence unparalleled in European history. According to statistics, about 600 terrorist groups from both the left and the right were active between 1969 and 1980. They brought about over 12,000 incidents, an average of 100 per month, 3 per day, which caused over 350 deaths and 4,500 injuries. The Red Brigades were the largest and strongest of the leftist terrorist groups. They were founded in 1970 in response to the public explosions plotted by neo-fascist terrorists from the Strage di Piazza Fontana in 1969 to the bombing of the Bologna train station in 1980, which we see here. It was the intensification of the student and worker protests in 1969 that triggered the so-called strategy of tension, which was a neo-fascist response on the part of underground groups in collusion with members of the Italian army and secret services that aimed at creating instability and panic as the preconditions for an authoritarian overturn. These neo-fascist groups did not acknowledge their actions publicly, while the leftist terrorists did. In fact, they adopted quite a different strategy. They would kidnap and kill specific people for specific reasons. So in 1970s, the wishful season of collective protests gave way to terrorist violence. And this resulted in an increasing alienation of the masses from political life and a widespread sense of disillusionment that became the leitmotif of the Anni di Piombo. In this deeply troubled context, artists and filmmakers became more and more interested in Italy's past and its national memory than its present. Instead of unraveling the enigmas of the present, most artists and film directors chose to look backward at the past. And in 1971, Pasolini played the role of the painter Giotto in his film Il Decameron, based on one of the best-known works of Italian literature written in the mid 14th century by Boccaccio. I'm going to show you two clips, one after the other. In the first, you'll see Pasolini as Giotto, ready to start painting a fresco in a church. And in the second, you'll see the grand tableau vivant of a famous fresco by Giotto that appears as part of a dream. There we go. There are several anachronisms and inventions in these recreations. The church we saw in the first clip is the church of Santa Chiara in Naples, where Giotto worked towards the end of his life in the 1320s. But in Boccaccio's novel, there is no reference to this. There is an anecdote about Giotto, but nothing about his work in Naples or the dream with the tableau vivant after the Last Judgment that Giotto painted in the Scrovegni Chapel in Padua. This is part of one of the most famous painting cycles in the history of Western art, as it signaled the revival of naturalism, which was to become the distinguishing trait of the Italian Renaissance. Pasolini made a number of significant changes to Giotto's fresco. Most prominent is the substitution of the figure of Christ in Giotto's fresco with that of a Madonna in Majesty. Pasolini justified this substitution with the widespread popular veneration of the Madonna, for the Madonna in Naples, but it has been said that the actress playing the Madonna, Silvana Mangano, is actually the archetype of the Oedipal mother in Pasolini's cinema. In the next film from 1972, Pasolini's other film, like the next one he directed, titled The Canterbury Tales and based on the collection of tales written by the British Geoffrey Chaucer in the late 14th century, we see Pasolini playing Chaucer and reading the Decameron in this rather comical clip that I'm going to show you now. Burned the book because it was prohibited, right, to have it and read it.
Geoffrey Chaucer!
Yes, my wife.
The model for Pasolini's reconstruction of Chaucer's studio was probably an Italian painting by Antonello da Messina depicting Saint Jerome. In fact, if we flip the image and then crop it, we'll see the similarities. It is not an exact citation, of course, as in the tableau vivant we've seen, but it is an example of other subtler ways in which Italian painting inspired Pasolini's film production. And here is the detail of another Italian painting from the early 15th century that features an elaborate version of the seat in Pasolini's scene. In conclusion, we've looked at works by three quite different figures who shared an interest in reviving, or shall we say, reliving, past art through the medium of performance. They looked back at history during difficult times of profound changes in Italian society, and they all did it with a sense of detachment and a good dose of irony. One of the most interesting aspects of this citationist phenomenon that we have peeked into is counterintuitive. Rather than a sign of disconnect from the present, engaging with the past can actually be a meaningful response to the present. Thank you very much. And now we have a few minutes for questions, if you have any. Yes.
Would the audiences who were seeing these works have associated them, as you have, shown us, with the originals, or did critics at the time or reviewers point that out when they were reviewing the works?
So let me just thank you all for being here. If you have to leave, I see a lot of people leaving. So your question is about whether the people seeing this, looking at these works, they would know the works that were being cited, right? Mm. That's a good question. Many of them, I would say yes, but at the same time, you're pointing at one of the problems, which is that this kind of work, of course, requires extra knowledge to appreciate. There is a level of it. If you don't know what they're referring to, what they're quoting, right, then you don't get part of the message. And this is what some people would call an elitist element, right, as aspect of the work. And this is exactly what I refer to as when I say that Pasolini, was going through this ideological crisis. So before La Ricotta, his films were not like this. So they so he was embracing a Marxist ideology, and he was making films for the people, the popolo. So. But then, once he understood that there was no longer the people, there was the middle class, there was the Italian, the Italiano medio, the average Italian, as his main audience, like, that was the audience, then he gave that up, right? And so, yeah, so I hope I answered your question.
But did
we have another question?
Did critics, though?
Oh, the critics.
And the reviewers?
Of course they did, yeah, they did, of course, yeah. And they reacted differently, of course, right? So yes, the critics, yeah.
But can you turn it around and say that all of this, that it's all parody, is actually a trap? It's saying that Italy is always doing this, but the moment when it's not doing this, or in fact the exception, like Rossellini or Little Moments, is that in fact it's a parody precisely of the Fratelli Fabri publications, and the whole thing parodies the fact that Italians will say this is this, and this is a citation of this, and this is a citation of that. And they're one step ahead of the game.
That's a good possible different way of looking at it. Reading Pasolini and his preoccupations, by thank you for coming, you get something different. So, I mean, if you saw in the interview, right, I mean, in the speech, when he was talking about the true fascism, right? So, that would be a second level. So, on the level of consciousness, these artists, and so especially Pasolini, is the one who really articulated his thoughts and preoccupations the most, right? If you listen to him, then you interpret it that way, right? But then on another level, right, it could be possible to see that, to take that point of view. But I think especially with Pistoletto, perhaps, I mean, I feel like he's the one who's, right, doing something more like a parody, really. Because with Pasolini, I feel like it's, there is a lot of respect. There is irony, yes, but I think it's with Pistoletto that you get that kind of, right? I mean, the sounds are so off, and the whole thing is, Yeah.
What's the meaning of that sound?
The meaning of that sound. Well, it's disturbing. It's distorting. It's making you more aware that this is not, like a nice tableau vivant that he's doing just for you to enjoy. The tradition of there is a strain in the tableau vivant tradition in Italy that was actually still alive. Still today, you have some of that, and it is part of. It's associated with entertainment and also religious practices. Yes, like you would have the nativity for Christmas, people posing. As a nativity in painting and just, like a tableau vivant. Or you would have during Easter, tableau vivant of staging the Passion of Christ. And actually, there are anthropologists studying these phenomena. And so it's clearly saying, well, this is not that, right? This is something, and as I said, I think it taps into this other experimental tradition in 20th century art that's, not want to please his audience, right? So, we call it the, shocking the bourgeoisie kind of thing. So that's what it is. We have another question in the back?
I always think of Italians as so more thoroughly imbued with their magnificent artistic heritage than people in other countries. And so I would expect that your lecture was fascinating because it seemed to me that Italian moviegoers would be more aware of what you were talking about than people in other countries would be aware of.
Mm.
I read once that half the world's art treasures are in Italy because of who they were.
Right. I think that, again, it's what's really interesting here is that there was this moment of dramatic change in Italian society. And going back to Rami, your question, the local realities, local traditions of Italy, very strong, right, that are now actually being revived at the time, through the Italian miracle and, the economic miracle and with the, bye, Renata. Thank you for coming. I do know some people I want to say goodbye. Thank you so much for coming. The TV was a very important phenomenon, and with that came American influence, like the cultural influence. So that is something to keep in mind. And as a result, so this is why Pasolini was so, in a way, conservative in his wanting to recuperate those traditions that he was seeing as being erased by this new culture of consumerism, the homogenization. So now we are at a different moment. In fact, there is all this recuperation of traditions, local traditions. There's the slow movement versus the fast, right? Fast food, slow move. It's very different, but we want to think of that particular context. We want to, right, travel back in time and try to imagine how it was back then. Mm-hmm. So.
How would you relate it to Francesco Vanzoli's film now?
Hmm. Yes, that would be an interesting counter, right, move, but at the same time, thank you, with some relationship, especially to what Pasolini was saying, yeah, absolutely, but going in a different direction, right, using different materials, right, no, going in a different direction, no, but using different materials, saying something very similar, right, okay, great, any other questions? Curiosities? No? I didn't say a lot of things because it's only a 40-something minute presentation. No other curiosity? Thank you. She is my advisor. I call fast. Ciao. Thank you.